you can see also, as we've mentioned in the past, also the apostate United States so-called Conference of Catholic Bishops put up right on their website that the campaigns, this is on their website, quote, campaigns that target Jews for conversion to Christianity are no longer theologically acceptable in the Catholic Church. This was actually on their website. They're saying we shouldn't try to convert anyone to Catholicism. This is the belief of the post-Vatican II Church. They do not believe that a person has to believe in Jesus Christ or the Catholic faith for salvation. Nothing could be clearer. And for people to accept these persons as Catholics when they hold this heretical position is to be a heretic.
And this showman, his book is actually, it's called Salvation from the Jews. I think I read the second bestseller for Ignatius Press, which is a huge bookseller. They publish almost all of Benedict XVI's books, huge Novus Ordo outfit. And so this is just being spread like, it's spreading like wildfire. And he also says that the idea that the church is the new people of God, that the church is the new Israel, is not correct. And it's all about the future nation state of Israel. So therefore, we should fund Antichrist Israel. We should help Antichrist Israel. That's the message. And other things like this. Even, and he says that those who destroy the nascent state of Israel well might be part of a diabolical attempt to prevent the second coming. So everything revolves around the Jewish state of Israel. And what I wanted to mention is that he's been attacked by these, and he's an utter heretic himself who believes in no salvation, he believes in salvation outside the church, who defends the validity of the new mass, who goes to the new mass, who doesn't think any of the Vatican II antipopes are heretics, but he's right on this matter. And people like Jacob Michael, this is a guy who is known by certain people in the traditional movement. He actually was formerly a supporter of the Society of St. Pius X, and he was involved in this booting the Buddhists from the Basilica that some people have heard about.
Up in Michigan.
Yeah, where the Buddhists had come into the Basilica, and they went in and organized a prayer and sort of forced the Buddhists out with a confrontation, which was a good thing to do. But he started to show even more profound bad will, this guy Jacob Michael. He started to try to explain away a lot of the heresies, and we're going to talk about some of that. He now is a total defender of the Vatican II religion, has now gone back to the new mass. And we just wanted to point this out, that when people start to defend this, when they start to demonstrate this kind of dishonesty, explaining away these clear heresies, trying to defend this kind of evil, that they'll be cursed by God, that God will take his grace away from them. And allow them to go even farther. And that's why we see now, he actually said, this guy Jacob Michael, who used to be sort of more traditional, he was an adherent of the Society of St. Pius X, now he says he would be open to going to a synagogue as an observer. He goes to the Novus Ordo Mass. They go out of their way to defend this guy Showman, who's trying to incorporate Jewish thinking into Catholic thinking. And so he's, by his own bad will and astounding pride, God has punished him and pulled his grace from him. And that's why he's now defending this type of horrible evil. And to give an example of the type of bad will that would cause God to punish him in that spiritual sense, he wrote something about us trying to defend Ratzinger's heresy that Protestantism is not heresy, trying to explain away this quote. I mean, the level of dishonesty and bad will that this requires, and I just wanted to read a sentence or a few sentences of what he says trying to defend this. And as you know, in our book and on our website, we pointed out that in his book, Christian Brotherhood, The Meaning of Christian Brotherhood, Benedict XVI says that Protestantism is not heresy. It's something different from heresy in the traditional sense, a phenomenon whose true theological place has not yet been determined. I mean, it doesn't get any more heretical than that. Pope Pius XI said that the heresies begotten by the Reformation were heresies. And he says, tries to explain this one away. He says, Ratzinger is thus right to say that today's situation, this is quoting Jacob Michael, within Protestantism is something different from heresy in the traditional sense, since it rarely involves the necessary condition of pertinacity or obstinacy. What exactly is involved in Protestantism today is, as Ratzinger said, a phenomenon whose true theological place has not yet been determined. This is not at all to say that the Protestant doctrines, considered in the abstract and apart from a person who believes in them, are not heretical. His words are quite obviously to be understood in the context of persons who have not willingly rejected the Catholic faith. Well, first of all, that's completely ridiculous. We can read the quote here. Ratzinger not only says that Protestants themselves are not heretics, but he says, after saying that, he says the conclusion is inescapable then, Protestantism, not just Protestants, Protestantism today is something different from heresy, in the traditional sense, a phenomenon whose true theological place has not yet been determined. So he's not just saying that the people aren't heretics, which is would be bad enough, but he's saying that Protestantism itself, meaning the religion, the teachings, is not heresy. And he doesn't offer any qualification. If he really believed that the Protestant doctrines were heretical, therefore some of the Protestants who adhere to them would be heretics, but he doesn't say any of them could be heretics. He generally says it's not heresy, they're not heretics. So this statement that Jacob Michael makes, that Benedict XVI still considers that Protestant doctrines considered in the abstract and apart from a person who believes in them are heretical, that's ridiculous. It's just a statement of a liar, a person who's of bad will, because anyone who would advance that type of argument is simply rejecting the clear facts. And he goes on to try to explain away Ratzinger's statement in God and the World and Milestones, where Ratzinger talks about how you can read the Jews are not to be considered of bad will because they don't see the Old Testament prophecies pointing to Christ. And Ratzinger says, the Old Testament prophecies don't point unequivocally to Christ. And he says, that's the key, unequivocally. They don't point unequivocally to Christ, Jacob Michael says. Well, that's pointless. That's an irrelevant statement, because Ratzinger is saying that the Jews, for rejecting him, are not to be considered of ill will. When our Lord says, Moses wrote of me, if you believed in what he said, you would believe in me. And he said, therefore, you are of your father, the devil. And he said, you will be condemned. So obviously contradicting that. And so it's just, this is the type of bad will that's demonstrated. These people are just, unfortunately, not honest. And that's why God pulls his grace from them. And that's why now he's back at the New Mass defending people incorporating Judaism into Catholic thinking. He's been punished spiritually by God. And that's why he's defending everything the Vatican II Church does. He's open now to going to a synagogue, and you could see it coming.
Yeah, and you can actually see this also from the Society of Pius X, because all the stuff that they're seeing from the hierarchy that they accept as being the Catholic hierarchy, they say that these guys are Catholics. And we can see this actually. One of the people that they promote quite a bit is Dr. David Alan White. Some of you are familiar with him. Brother Edmund Hoyle, who's a member of our community, happened to know Dr. White a little bit, got to know him a few years ago. Some of the things that he actually heard from Dr. White are quite interesting. He advised Brother Edmund, actually, not to speak to his brother or sister about the Catholic faith while they're under his parents' roof. While he was under his parents' roof. I mean, and he's actually a convert. I mean, this is equivalent to a denial of the faith, to not tell, you have to tell people, family members and others, of where they're headed if they don't convert. He also didn't know about the new rite of ordination, but thought that Mel Gibson's movie that he put out a couple of years ago on the Passion of the Christ was an excellent film guided by the Holy Ghost, and Mel Gibson decided not to have a priest come on his set, or a so-called priest that was ordained the new rite of ordination. And so the fact that Mel Gibson didn't bring the new rite of ordination, quote, priest, onto his set, he felt that that was a strong argument against the validity of the new rite of ordination. And that's not the way you judge things. You have to judge it by what the church teaches. He also said that that we actually showed, referring to Brother Peter and myself, a rage for telling people not to pray for the repose of John Paul II's soul after he died. No, you can't pray for public heretics. It's just that simple. So he's basically saying that this apostate...
He's not only saying that he could have been saved, but he's saying that those who conclude that he should not be prayed for because he was considered damned are showing un-Catholic rage. I mean, that's the statement of a person without any faith. And before he continues, I just wanted to mention that this is a guy who has appeared. This Dr. White is hugely promoted by these false traditionalist groups. He was on the cover of the Angelus magazine and
at least once, maybe twice.
Stories are linked to and all kinds of, and promoted by various groups. So,
and he has actually given some very good talks, but...
Yeah, he gave one very interesting talk on how, like, the modern music, explaining how music is ordered, and how even if you put aside the lyrics, the modern music is inherently disordered, and that's why you could never have, like, Christian rock.
And probably worst of all, though, that he told Brother Edmund is that he actually said to him that most in heaven will actually have been non-Catholics when we arrive, and that most Catholics on earth will go to hell. I mean, that's
what he said. That's amazing.
It's just,
he believes in salvation outside the church. There's no doubt about that. And he believes in it to such an extent that he believes that most people in heaven will be non-Catholics.
This is a
huge figure promoted by these false traditionalist groups. He's an utter unbeliever. I mean, he doesn't have the faith one bit.
No.
So, I mean, it's a frightening realization. And so it's sad, you know.
And then we have the Society of Pius X that was running that article.
Yeah, there's an interesting article that I just came across on a website I don't almost never look at, but there's an article on Tradition in Action. I looked at it for the first time in a while. And they had an article on one of the leaders of the Catholic distributist movement, and his name was Eric Gill. And the Society of St. Pius X in their Angelus magazine carried an article by this gentleman who lived in the 30s. And it turns out that this guy, Eric Gill, was a pedophile, an adulterer. He was incestuous. He was just such a moral reprobate, and his art is pornographic, according to those who have written the exposés. And the Society of St. Pius X carried an article on education by this guy. And when this expose of this man, Eric Gill, was published by this group, Father Peter Scott of the Society of St. Pius X actually criticized them for publishing this article, which exposed this utter disgrace. They published this article exposing this guy for what he really is. I mean, it's so horrible what he was involved with that you couldn't even really speak about it. And so rather than Father Peter Scott saying that, yes, we weren't aware of how horrible this man really was, and therefore we would never publish anything from him again, no, instead he says that they sinned by making explicit what he actually was involved with and tearing the mask away from this guy's evil life. And so I think that's quite revealing about how the Society of St. Pius X, and especially those high up in it, someone like Father Peter Scott, unfortunately, they're not good people. They're faithless people, and they further evil by that kind of attitude.
And this Tradition in Action group actually got a question because, in spite of all the evidence that they bring forward to prove that these anti-popes are, these so-called popes are anti-popes, and these other guys that are claiming to be the leadership of the Catholic Church are heretics, they don't call them that, haven't called them that. They haven't just said these guys are heretics. They just say, you know, these are modernists. You know, they're very liberal. They don't
progressive,
yeah. And so someone actually wrote in and said, why don't you just call these people heretics? And so they actually finally, they responded to this question. They said, actually, we believe that to call someone a liberal.
I could read his email. It's somewhat interesting. He writes in, he says, I think, however, you should long ago have reached the point where you can and should confidently substitute the words heretical and or apostate for progressivist throughout much, if not all, of your site. these men, referring to the leaders in the Novus Ordo Church, were progressivists for perhaps the first or second time they said or did something in public contrary to the faith. After that, they fell into formal heresy and or apostasy, and then ipso facto out of the church. Most Novus Ordo churchmen were educated in the Catholic faith and are presumed to know when their actions are heretical. They are also presumed to know the consequences of such actions. To continue to label these outrageous destroyers of the holy faith as mere progressivists affords them undeserved latitude. One also denigrates the church by suggesting that those who obstinately engage in heresy and apostasy are still members of her. Such a position contradicts Catholic theology and canon law. While your efforts are admirable, widely read traditionalist organizations such as yours need to stop giving false respect to these heretics and start denouncing the Novus Ordo for what it is, a wretched and highly deceptive heretical sect abhorrent to God and opposed to his church. Well, he's basically repeating a point we've made over and over again about this group, failing to denounce these guys as heretics. And the response is interesting. They say that you have misunderstood what we mean by, I'm paraphrasing, you've misunderstood what we mean by the use of progressivism. They say, we're not just saying that it's liberalism, we're saying that it's
equivalent to heresy.
Yeah, it's equivalent to heresy. They say, we use progressivist, to refer to a particular school of thought inside the Catholic Church which follows the same errors of modernism, surpassing this heresy in its broader and deeper consequences. And he says, they say to qualify someone as a modernist is to qualify him as a pernicious heretic. So they're hammered down, they're pinned down here by his arguments. And so they're admitting that by calling him a progressivist, they're admitting that these guys are heretics. But they don't come right out and let their general readers know this readily, that or the consequences of this. So what do they believe? Heretics can be inside the church?
And that's why when you actually had a conversation a few years ago with Attila Gamarra's, who's part of that group, he said he basically is saying the same thing that we're saying, and
But he said he must take into account the psychology of the people, and so he continued to call him Pope, and they probably would still call him Pope. So that just shows their dishonesty, unless they come out and explicitly and clearly indicate that they regard the leadership of the Vatican II sect as heretics outside the church.
And actually, they came out with some Sister Lucy information, fake Sister Lucy. They actually went a little bit deeper into analyzing the differences and looking at the differences between the fake Sister Lucia and the real one. And but ironically, they only came out with this information, how they believe this modern so-called Sister Lucia is a fraud, after we posted a whole giant article about the fake Sister Lucia. And to me, that's also very interesting. Again, once maybe the people start to accept it, okay, we can bring out the truth.
Yeah, see, until we came out with it and people started to accept that this was a real possibility in somewhat large numbers, then they said, okay, the atmosphere is such where, you know, we can feel somewhat secure in bringing out our position on this. And they even incorporated some of the quotes that, you know, like that were used in the article we had. And so that's the type of attitude where, you know, they're always fearing what people think rather than readily proclaiming the truth. Another news item I wanted to talk about, it was all over the mainstream news organizations, was that this guy, this radio host, Don Imus, was fired from his job for criticizing the Rutgers women's basketball team. Some of you may have heard about this. And we just wanted to offer a quick comment about this, which was supposedly his statements were obviously bad about the Rutgers women's basketball team. And this guy, I'm sure, is unfortunately a pagan. But he was accused of being racist and so forth, and he was fired from his job. But what's interesting is, I think it was about a year and a half ago, the mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, who's an African-American, he actually said that God wants New Orleans to be a chocolate city.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just an amazing statement. I mean, if a white mayor actually made a statement like New Orleans should be a vanilla city, I mean, there would be riots probably. There'd be marches. And you know, I mean, they would say, well, look, I mean, this guy's a racist. And obviously, we would agree. But you notice that actually, like, Al Sharpton, probably if you ask him, or Jesse Jackson, you know, should he resign?
Yeah.
Should he step down? Is he a racist?
No.
No.
And nothing. He got off basically totally free for making the statement. And racism is condemned by Catholic teaching. It's stupid. It's illogical. But we just wanted to point out this double standard of these liberals who think that they're standing up for the truth and justice and, you know, standing against racism. Meanwhile, when these people make clearly racist comments, I mean, that's one of the most racist statements I've ever heard a public official make. New Orleans should be a chocolate city. I mean, basically nothing happens.
Yeah. So
that's what we wanted to say about that.
So also some of the other news items that could be seen on the website. This one, headline, April 10, 2007. Catholic school libraries stock gay promoting books and videos, warns pro-marriage group. I mean, they're actually stocking now at these Novus Ordo schools in Ontario books that promote homosexuality and lesbianism. Another February 21st, 2007, so-called Catholic University of Detroit proposing abortion agencies as career opportunities for students. This is the University of Detroit Mercy, claims to be a Catholic institution. Its official website lists Planned Parenthood as a career opportunity for students. And actually, Planned Parenthood actually boasted that they actually have employed a person that formerly went to Detroit Mercy University. From Germany, a Catholic, so-called Catholic church, of course, collects money for a mosque. I mean, this is just amazing. It says both the board of Cologne's St. Theodore Catholic Church and the parish council have unanimously approved the action of giving donations for the building of a mosque in Germany. I don't see how anyone can't see what's going on here, that this is total apostasy. I mean, they're funding a mosque. It's just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, and then you have these people who are worried about criticism of guys like Roy Schoeman, and they're under bishops who approve of this kind of activity. I mean, you talk about the blindness. It's just staggering.
And you had also recently the Diocese of Davenport, Iowa, and San Diego, California, both filed for bankruptcy. It goes on and on. San Francisco Archbishop, quote, very happy about a plan which makes it possible for adoption workers to refer homosexual couples to adopt children. I mean, this is what we're, you know, I mean, it's just amazing. It really is. Alaskan Bishop headlines gay, quote, Catholic conference. Amazing. And the move to canonize John Paul II moves forward. And I wonder actually what people are going to say, because if this goes on long enough, that is going to be something that happens in the near future. What is the Society Pius X going to do at that point? What is, what are these other groups going to do? Are they going to accept this, quote, canonization? They will have to.
Yeah, that's when they've been compromising, obviously, unfortunately, in almost all of the cases we're describing, sinning mortally because they've seen the evidence, they've seen the clear heresies, they've seen the teaching of the church proving the point. But when that occurs, then they'll reach a new level of the denial of Christ. I mean, to accept this guy as a saint whom they all know was involved in the most antichrist activity, it's really going to be a big thing.
Yes, yeah, another one, March 21st, 2007. Jesuit school offers sympathetic looks at abortion, contraception, same-sex marriage. We also just got something recently. The apostate so-called Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles had another big conference of speakers, and this, quote, conservative Novus Ordo group's complaining about how just about every one of them promote homosexuality, lesbianism, contraception, abortion rights, on and on and on. This is your, if you accept this guy, he's your head, he's part of your church.
And one question we recently got was, how do people like Scott Hahn not see it? You know, someone who's, you know, claims to study the faith and study the Bible. And the answer is, in my opinion, that if they don't really believe in the necessity of the church, which unfortunately almost none of them do, if they don't really believe that all who die as non-Catholics are lost, if they don't come to accept that foundational dogma, then they won't hate heresy. They don't believe the church is truly supernatural. And therefore, you can basically forget about trying to convince them of this. Like Scott Hahn on one program we heard, his co-host Mike Aquilina in one of his shows, they're talking about Islam, and Mike Aquilina said, "No disrespect intended."
Because Scott Hahn apparently seemed to make some statement, maybe that people could have taken as an insult to Islam, and he was quick to say, "Not that we mean any insult to the Islamic religion," and he goes, "Absolutely not."
Yeah, that's what he said, and so he's denying what he knows to be the teaching of the New Testament.
It's apostasy.
So yeah, and so that's the type of compromise. And so if they don't really believe Christ is necessary, and if they don't have that foundation, they don't really hate heresy, then there's really no chance for them to be convinced.
And that's why, for example, this Father Francis Stone, Mary Stone, when Benedict XVI went into the synagogue, is praising his visit. "We thank the, quote, Holy Father for this act of true ecumenism." That's why Benedict Groeschel, the apostate so-called Franciscan priest from the New York City area, talked about how after Cardinal John O'Connor died, how the Jews held some kind of Jewish service in the cathedral, and Mother Angelica said, "That's awesome." This is in, actually, the EWTN section of the new book. We have a lot of interesting information about EWTN, how early on in her career Mother Angelica got involved with the charismatic movement, how she seems to admit that stuff's coming out, words are coming out of her mouth that she doesn't even intend to come out of her mouth.
Yeah, something we haven't talked about on a radio program since this is the first one we've done since the book's been published, but there are some parts of the book that we can talk about. Actually, at the head of that section, there's a quote really revealing, in our view, from the biography that, you know, you went through by Raymond Arroyo on Mother Angelica. He found a lot of interesting things in there. And the quote said that after she had hands laid on her by this charismatic priest, the charismatic laid priests on Mother. A week later, a foreign tongue spilled from Mother Angelica's mouth inexplicably. She tried to say something, but something else came out. And we tell the story in the book about the guy that we were in contact with who had been involved in joint
television. Yeah, actually, yeah. A guy that I know was heavily involved in the charismatic movement and went to these healing services and for Massachusetts. And he actually said that when he was at one of the meetings, he actually felt a demon enter into him. I mean, he felt the demon actually come into during this healing, charismatic healing service. And he also mentioned how many of these also so-called miracles are temporary healings that come back. The illness or the problem that they have comes back in a much more terrible form later. After a seemingly partial healing that occurs over a short period of time that comes back worse later. And he actually also said, this was really, really interesting, that the healing priest he actually saw, he was watching him, he went into a room, and he actually said, he claims he saw a demon. And he said that the demon went into this room and the only person in the room was the priest, and the priest came back out, you know, to start his healing service. I mean, this is what you're dealing with, and that's why in the, quote, extreme forms, the radical forms, as some people would call them, of this charismatic movement, you'll see people rolling on the ground, barking like dogs, oinking like pigs. It's the manifestation of diabolical possession.
And we were thinking about why would this particular form of false worship and participation in the new religion be so open to demonic possession. And we make the point in the book, which we believe answers the question, which is that the reason God allows so many people to be taken over is because he instituted the seven sacraments. And one of those sacraments is the laying on of hands and the sacrament of confirmation, which transmits the Holy Spirit. And so what the charismatic movement essentially is participation in a new sacrament. Okay, it's not the sacrament of confirmation. A new sacrament which involves the laying on of hands in order to transmit the Spirit. And so because people have become involved in a new rite, which involves the laying on of hands in order to transmit the Spirit, a new rite which has not been set up by Christ, but a new rite of their own devising, it is a satanic initiation into the evil spirit. So they don't get the Holy Spirit because they've gone outside the means. They've rejected the way that God has set up that you receive the Spirit through the laying on of hands and created their own, and therefore they're opened up to the devil. And I believe that is the reason why we see such a common result of demonic activity in the charismatic movement.
And that's why, like, if people say that, well, who blessed this movement? It was Paul the VI, John Paul II met with charismatic people all the time. They blessed this movement, of course. There are many other interesting stories that we actually could have included in this large book, but we mainly want to stick to the facts. And you talk to different people, you hear some different stories. For example, there was actually one priest, this is decades ago, who was part of a marriage tribunal, very old priest now, Byzantine Rite priest. And when he was in this room to meet Paul the VI, he went forward to shake his hand, or actually he came into the room. And as soon as Paul VI entered the room, all his hair stood out on end. He said it was like being in the presence of a live demon.
That's what he told you. That's amazing.
And this is what this Byzantine Rite priest said he experienced. And then another very old priest offers the traditional mass, extremely old. He actually also met Paul VI, and he was the one, actually, he went forward to shake his hand. And when he was about to shake his hand, he looked at Paul VI, and he said that he saw in the face of Paul VI, he said, like thousands of devils. And actually, when he was flying back to America, he first thought, he said, well, maybe there's something wrong with me, maybe. This is before he knew about and saw all the rest of the changes that Paul VI made and all the heresies of Paul VI, because he had been taught that, you know, obviously you revere this man, obviously, and if he's a true pope, a good one. Interesting stories like that. One in regards to John Paul II that was very interesting from another woman who was in Paul VI Hall, which is this, I think it seats about 10,000 people. It's next to the Vatican. And they're in there for John Paul II's audience. And she said that before he came out, she was in there for hours before he came out. They played rock music for hours. And she was just like, I mean, this is not appropriate. And then finally, when he's about to come out, John Paul II, they start to play this famous song that she said she was familiar with called, I think it's St. Louis Woman, which is from, I don't know, it's 1940s. And she said it's a famous song about a whore. And so they play, it's a stripper music, she said. And so a German marching band is playing this famous song about a whore, and that's what John Paul II walked out to.
And that's
just incredible. I mean, talking about the whore of Babylon, and the head of the whore of Babylon at that time, John Paul II.
Wasn't that one of the things that opened her up to, or caused her to be open to
that
material?
Yep, that's right. It was many years ago, actually, she got issue one. And initially was like, is this right? But had that experience. And so therefore was actually open to the information, actually was convinced by it after being herself another person that was in the charismatic movement. Actually, another lady comes to mind when she was in a group to meet John Paul II and he was shaking hands and she said, we love you, Holy Father. That's what she said. And he looked at her. And he was smiling, and then he started to really stare at her with a really mean, angry look. For no reason, it seemed. And this was another lady that later on got some of our information and was willing to take a look at it. Maybe because, you know, maybe John Paul II, being possessed, could perceive some goodwill in this lady. But very interesting stories like this, many of which could be spoken about.
And I think that ties in. We were talking about how those who start to defend these heresies and dishonestly explain them away are spiritually punished by God, and so he'll allow them to go. There was a guy named Stephen Hand. Some of you may have heard about him. He wrote for the Remnant for a while, and so was at least opposed to some of the ecumenism and the new religion. And then he made a trip to Rome. And then after his trip to Rome,
he's working as a correspondent for them, doing some news story about something that was going on, covering actually the, I think it was the October pan-Christian encounter that John Paul II held in October of 1999.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an extremely diabolical event that he was going to cover.
And he went over there and came back and was a total defender of the Vatican II religion, denouncing anyone who would even criticize Vatican II or the new mass, going out of his way to defend the false church. And it's quite obvious, in our opinion, that he was essentially cursed in a certain way, that God spiritually punished him because he showed some bad will by opening himself up to the profound evil he was witnessing. And therefore, he came out of it as basically a servant of the anti-church and someone who was controlled by the devil. And God pulled his grace, even to see the truth at all, away from him. And so he started to attack the truth. And so that's why this stuff is very evil. You know,
yeah, it really is. I actually had a conversation one time with Father Fiore, who was a very good friend of Malachi Martin. And I had heard the rumors that Cardinal Bernardine of Chicago was a person that was accused of raping at least one woman. And I heard that through, I think, Father John O'Connor, who just recently died. And what was interesting is that some people were saying maybe he was involved in this famous black mass that Malachi Martin describes in his book Windswept House, down in, I believe it's Columbia, South Carolina, a joint black mass held in Columbia, South Carolina, and also underneath or in the Vatican, where they actually held black masses in both places, sort of swearing in or inducting the ground to Satan. And that this took place, Malachi Martin, I believe, describes on June 29th, 1963, the beginning, actually, of the reign of Paul VI as antipope. And what was interesting is that he actually confirmed for me that it was Cardinal Bernardine who is the high priest of this black mass in Columbia, South Carolina. Cardinal Bernardine was the former head of the U.S. Conference of So-Called Catholic Bishops back in the 1970s. He was also a person at his death that had a gay men's choir and a Masonic band play. And he also, actually, someone just showed this. This was really fascinating. A film came out where they show actually the cathedral under Bernardine in Chicago, where they have these stones, like marble stones that are up on the wall, just bizarre, hideous little stones and so forth. And this guy was showing what, as far as when you combine the stones in different ways, you actually get faces of demons, bats, all kinds of horned creatures.
Yeah.
This is who you're dealing with. You're dealing with Antichrist.
Yeah. And one other thing I wanted to do, talk about the question of passive attendance at non-Catholic services. And we were going to post something on our website, perhaps, you know, as early as tonight, which it's a quote from our book on the topic, which we've always pointed out that we strongly oppose the idea that people can go for funerals and weddings to Novus Ordo churches or to Protestant churches. And some people have been of the position that you can go for funerals or weddings to Protestant churches or Novus Ordo churches as long as you don't actively participate. And we've pointed out that, no, you're honoring people who are involved in heretical activities and so forth. But the quote that we feel bears some relevance to this topic is found in our new book in the section on the Catholic Church versus the Vatican II Church on partaking in non-Catholic worship, page 235. We're going to post this on our website very soon, probably tonight. Pope Pius IX, in his encyclical Gravis ad Doctrinae from 1875, he's speaking of the old Catholic heretics, And he says that they are outside the church, etc. And he says they, the faithful, should totally shun their religious celebrations, their buildings, and their chairs of pestilence, which they have with impunity established to transmit the sacred teachings. He says you should totally shun their religious celebrations, speaking of notoriously heretical sects, such as the old Catholics, Protestant sects. Okay, so if you can must totally shun their religious celebrations and their buildings, obviously you can't show up there for a wedding or a funeral. And that's not the tradition of the church. It's something, it's an idea that developed when liberalism started to pop up at the late 1800s, early 1900s, that you could be present there as long as you don't participate. And so we believe this quote bears relevance to refuting that.
Because it's totally scandalous. If you're telling people that you have to become a Catholic to be saved, and then you show up at the funeral of a Protestant, and all the people see you there, they're going to say, yeah, he even believes that she or he may have made it, you know. It's totally scandalous. It doesn't make any sense. It's a total scandal.
And an interesting example of this is we were contacted by a guy who purported to be a traditional Catholic from Pennsylvania. His daughter was getting married in a Protestant church, and he told her he would not go, and she was extremely upset about this. She was complaining and called him, and he kept calling us again and again.
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't know if he actually was going to not go at the beginning. I actually talked to him. I said, you cannot go. And so he said, okay. And he told his daughter.
Yeah, so he agreed not to go at one point.
Yeah, he agreed. And then all of a sudden his daughter, oh, no, you can't do this. And he actually called up here, you know, saying that we're evil and all the other stuff. Yeah.
Well, you could see that he was feeling the pressure, that she was gravely offended by the fact that he would not go. That the fact that he would not go served as a witness, served as an admonition to her that he did not approve of this, and he did not approve of it so much that he's not even going to show up. And that was like a standing rebuke.
Yeah.
And so if she could get him to show up, that would basically settle her conscience, confirm her in her false marriage or her wrong activity. And so she kept, you know, hammering him over this, and eventually he gave in, compromised to please his daughter, and went. And we believe it was a grave sin.
Oh yeah.
And I found it very interesting because it showed how his not even going at all served as such a witness to what was going on.
And also, I mean, it makes you think about, you know, our Lord talking about he who loves his family more than me.
Oh, yeah.
There it is. It's something where he worshipped his daughter instead of God.
Yep.
And that's just simply, you know, what happened. Someone, you know, was mentioning about the objection that you can't take the state of a contest position because no one can judge the Holy See. This objection, of course, is covered in the book, that it's speaking about a supreme pontiff when he's speaking ex cathedra. That's when the judgment of the first see cannot be judged by anyone. That's what it's specifically talking about. The ex cathedra pronouncements of a true pope cannot be judged. You know, it's something where, and actually, Sam Robert Bellarmine is talking about the person of a pope personally can be judged. That's why in his quote he says that a pope who's a manifest heretic automatically ceases to be pope and head of the church, just as he ceases automatically to be a Christian and a member of the church. Wherefore, he can be judged and punished by the church. This is the teaching of all the ancient fathers that manifest heretics immediately lose all jurisdiction. So, If he's a manifest heretic, he can be judged by the others as having deviated from the Catholic faith. And that's why bishops, if they depose someone who is claiming to be a pope, they could only go through the process of deposing him because he's automatically already been deposed by the fact that he's a public heretic and outside the church. And so they're not deposing a valid pope. Bishops can't do that. If they ever did that, they would be deposing a person who claims to be a pope but is outside the church and is actually an anti-pope.
And it also comes from the early church, where in the early church you had, you know, patriarchs who would, you know, hold trials about the conduct of certain bishops. But they said no one can judge the first see, meaning no one can judge the see of Rome, the bishop of Rome. So no bishop could, you know, call the Bishop of Rome to a trial and say, we're going to examine you. That's what it means. It has nothing to do with recognizing that a manifest heretic who claims to be the Pope cannot be.
And ironically, these same people, for example, adherents or followers of the Society of Pius X and others, actually do that very thing. The canonizations of saints, they don't accept.
Or Vatican II.
The documents of Vatican II. So much for not judging the Holy See. That's exactly what they do. It's just quite ironic how they're talking about no one can judge the Holy See when they're rejecting the authoritative canonizations of the men that they deem to be Pope. They're rejecting the authoritative confirmations of the documents of Vatican II. They reject all of them. This other person was talking about, you know, we have to be obedient. You know, we have to be in obedience. And the Society of Pius X has a system where, you know, others have to be obedient to other higher-ups. I mean, they're just a little group that has set up a gentleman's agreement between the priests and the bishops to work together. But they're completely outside the church that these people believe is the one true church. The hierarchy, you could ask the Novus Ordo hierarchy whether they accept the Society of Pius X as being part of the Catholic Church, and they'll tell you no. They're not in communion with the Catholic Church. They would tell you that they're schismatics. And so that's the answer to that one, but the book covers that objection also.
And one email I just wanted to read, this was a question about St. Alphonsus of the Glories of Mary, and I just wanted to quickly read this. We were beginning to read through the Glories of Mary by St. Alphonsus. We encountered a story which related that a person who had obstinately lived a life full of sin died without the aid of any sacraments from the church or one of her ministers, a priest, yet went to purgatory. It was related through the soul's conversation with Sister Catherine of St. Augustine that the Blessed Virgin had enabled this person to make an act of contrition just prior to her death, which allowed her to escape hell, and she was also granted a shorter time in purgatory than which should have lasted for years. I thought that if a soul was obstinate in sins, that God would cloud that person's ability to be able to be sorrowful at death's doorstep, and that one had to have recourse to the sacraments for justification. Couldn't someone, after reading this example, make a statement that anyone could make a final plea to Mary at their deathbed, regardless of which faith tradition one had been a part of? And they were wondering about this, and the answer is he's obviously talking about someone who's been baptized as a Catholic, and it doesn't contradict the teachings of the Church at all, because the Church teaches that for a baptized Catholic, in an extraordinary case, a person could have perfect contrition, which involves not only sorrow for the sin and the fear of having gone to hell, but also sorrow for having offended God. That plus a desire for the sacrament of penance can restore a person to the state of grace prior to the sacrament of confession, according to the Council of Trent's teaching. And so God could grant that in unusual cases. Obviously, the spiritual writers say that's very, very rare, but it could happen. I mean, you don't have to believe this. This is just a private revelation. And so, but it shouldn't in any way cause a person to lessen the justice of God or think that they can get away with things. And that's why that book, The Glories of Mary, has as its focus the mercy of God and like stories like that. And so obviously a person could read a book which is about hell and they would read a lot of different things. But I wanted to read another story that's in that book, which is quite interesting. St. Alphonsus says in The Glories of Mary, page 659, in the year 1611, in the celebrated Sanctuary of Mary in Monte Vergine, it happened that on the vigil of Pentecost, the people who thronged there profaned that feast with balls, excesses, and immodest conduct, when a fire suddenly was discovered bursting forth from the house of entertainment where they were feasting, so that in less than an hour and a half it was consumed, and more than 1,500 persons were killed. Five persons who remained alive affirmed upon oath that they had seen the Mother of God herself with two lighted torches set fire to the inn. So that's in St. Alphonsus' The Glory of Mary, Glories of Mary, page 659, saying that people saw the Blessed Virgin lighting fire to the building which consumed these mortal sinners. I mean, so that's an illustration of how, you know, if anyone takes away from that they can, you know, just sin and they'll somehow get a last chance.
Yeah, it's just, and also it's the prom, like the promises of the brown scapular. People say, well, as long as I wear it, I can do anything. No, when you look at it, you have to keep the state of grace, have the faith, obviously. There are other things that are attached to wearing the scapular. It's not just the scapular alone. And so some people have this, you know, misunderstanding. One thing we also wanted to mention is that many of the people that seem to be in a complete fog and just can't get the point on a lot of these issues, basically you always find out that they usually only say the five-decade rosary. And so we wanted to stress again how critically important the 15-decade rosary, sincerely praying that 15-decade rosary every day is, because anyone who does that, we believe, you know, will, you know, come out of the fog and they won't be in heresy on anything if they consistently do that sincerely. So we will close this program, and we plan to be back with you next Friday night, not Saturday, at 9 o'clock. Thanks.